Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about writer's work, how writing works, and why the best writers risk being strange. And this is my second episode on The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. I think this is a brilliant novel in every way. I think it's an especially interesting novel for writers to look at. One, in terms of characterization, especially the characterization of Eleanor Vance, is what I discussed in the other episode. So if you haven't already checked it out, you can go check out my other episode on Hill House, which is all about Eleanor Vance, the one that, you know, we kind of dropped last week. This this episode is going to be focused on the narrative voice, this really fascinating approach that Jackson has to narrative voice. It's one of the most interesting narrative voices I've ever seen. And then on top of that, some of the ways in which she engineers the plot and the character reactions in such a way that they knit together. I think that the narration and then these kind of plot structuring of action and reaction are just brilliantly done, just masterful. So I'm going to look at a couple real precise examples. I'm going to discuss the ending of the book in some detail in these two episodes, by the way. If I haven't already ruined the ending for you in the other episode, if you're listening to this one first, you'll be forewarned. If you haven't read The Haunting Hill House, you may want to do so before you listen to these episodes. But, you know, maybe this episodes are how you're going to convince yourself to read The Haunting Hill House. You know, I read it every year. It doesn't get worse, it gets better. And I know everything that happens in that book. Check out The Haunting Hill House. Check out the other episode as well as this one where I discuss The Haunting Hill House. Also go to strangeinc.ca and check out my newsletter. You know, you can get a ghost story, my own ghost story that I wrote, if you go to strangeinc.ca about the haunting in a house. And as a matter of fact, I wouldn't say it's as good as Jackson's, but I think it's, you know, a nice little story that you'll like. And it's got its own kind of interesting, unusual approach to the narrative voice. So strangeinc.ca is where you can sign up to the newsletter and get that free ghost story. And also I'll send you this regular newsletter, like I say, where I tell you about what I'm doing, show you some draft work, give you some more recommendations, and share some writing tips. You can reply to that, tell me what you think about Hill House. Go to strangeinc.ca and let's keep in touch. Without further ado, let's talk about The Haunting of Hill House. There are a lot of things to look at with The Haunting of Hill House. I want to just start with a strange aspect of the book, which I think is one of the most interesting formal aspects of the book, and which I think accounts for a lot of its lasting power and a lot of its creepiness factor. You know, a lot of the actual effects of the book, I think, can be explained by this strange way that Jackson has approached the narration. So if you look at the narrative voice and the quality of that narrative voice, what we have is a authorial narrator. So this author figure, you know, not a character-based narrator, but an authorial, non-character-based narrator. Somebody who's not inside the world of that story. They are talking about everything in the third person. So it's, you know, narrator talking to you about these third people, Eleanor, Luke, and so on, Theo. All these characters are being discussed in the third person. This is a story written in the third person. So yeah, it's not coming from the author's point of view, precisely. It's all about these other characters. This is an author who has almost omniscient level of information. The author has knowledge of what is going on inside of Eleanor's head, can relay it to us. He always tells us what Eleanor is thinking, tells us what other characters are thinking. and so on and so forth. We have a very reliable narrator. You know, all this adds up to the standard, you know, reliable narrator. You know, somebody who, when they tell us, you know, that Eleanor is wants, imagines this cup of stars, you know, symbolizes some sort of childhood innocence or power or independence or imagination. You know, she has this point of view on the cup of stars. We're told that, and you know, she, we accept it. We accept this is what Eleanor is really thinking. She's actually in that, you know, coffee, that she's actually in that place, and she's actually seeing this kid act in this way and so on. And it's very reliable. We don't suspect the narrator is lying to us, in other words, or has any personality at all that would indicate some sort of warping or distortion of the information that we're getting. We have a very standard narrator, except there's one thing that the narrator cannot tell us any information about. There is one quality that the narrator has that is very unusual, which is that despite being able to read characters' minds, despite being able to tell us everything that is happening, what the narrator does not know is what haunts Hill House. If Hill House is haunted, what does haunt Hill House? We get this amazing opening passage, which is repeated almost verbatim at the end of the novel, which suggests, by the way, a circularity, right? You know, we have this opening paragraph and the same paragraph more or less exactly repeated by the end or at the end. And one of the lines there, the line that the book ends on is, silence lay steadily upon the wooden stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there walked alone. So we have the idea, one, that something walks Hill House. You know, there's something there, whatever it is haunted by, whatever it is that haunts Hill House. Hill House itself are partially is, you know, totally alive and just in and of itself is a living organism. That's a possibility that's suggested in this novel, that Hill House itself is just wrong. It's a wrong place. It's a bad place. It itself is haunted in the sense that it is alive and it is almost operating like a ghost of nothing, a ghost of it. It just is alive, like a living organism somehow. But it's also suggested that there's actually something in Hill House that haunts it. And we get different possibilities for the ghosts. You know, it could be Hugh Crane. It could be, you know, any number of figures. There's these various women that have died in the house or on the grounds. There's the owner, again, the guy who constructed Hill House, his original owner, who we had the suggestion was interested in the supernatural and the occult, may or may not have constructed Hill House to occult specifications. You know, it has built very strangely. We get the idea that even as it was being built, you know, there's people getting injured and people refusing to work on it and so on. Like the idea that somehow the house is just bad in and of itself, or, you know, one of these people who died on the grounds haunts it. We don't know. We don't know. We never know. We don't find out by the end of the novel what is haunting Hill House. The last line confirms this. You know, whatever walks there, we still don't know by the end of this novel what walks there. We have no more information about Hill House in the last paragraph than in the first paragraph, to the degree that it is repeating the paragraphs of verbatim. And not only do we not have this information, well, one, we don't have the information because the novel has not delivered the information. This narrator has not been able to tell us what haunts Hill House because the narrator doesn't know. The narrator knows everything about this world except what haunts Hill House. So there's a very strange and disturbing quality to the narration. It's almost as if Hill House itself exceeds the narrative situation. It's almost as if this novel, this horror story has this, you know, monster in it that is able to transcend the situation of being in the story. You know, there's something about Hill House that is unexplainable even to the person telling us about Hill House, even to the person who has invented Hill House. There's some
way in which they don't have a grasp on it. You know, that paragraph is very, that opening paragraph is a fascinating paragraph in many respects, not the least for the strange quality of the narration that it establishes immediately, that, you know, even I, the narrator, do not know what haunts Hill House. Whatever walks there, though, we know it walks alone. We have this very, before that, we get established the idea that's of what Hill House is. Whatever Hill House is, we are told, it is a place of absolute reality, where it is not possible to dream. Now, that is a very strange claim to make, because as unreal as the events of Hill House seem to be, we have, you know, all these strange occurrences happening inside Hill House, to all these sort of hauntings that are happening. But we are told, before anything unusual happens, all these kind of surreal or unreal occurrences that they're not even sure, like, did this really happen? What's really going on? Did we dream that? Did it actually happen? We're told from the very first moment, it's not possible to dream in Hill House. Everything in Hill House is not just a place where dreams can't happen. It is a place of absolute reality. It is the most real place in the world. It is so, it is more real than anywhere else on earth. And that is why you go mad if you stay there too long. That is why, you know, Hill House itself is mad. Hill House is not sane. We know it is not sane. We know it is a place of absolute reality. We know some, whatever that means, it means that it is haunted. Whatever that means. And we know nothing else. And neither does the narrator. And we never find out. And we just watch these people moving through this situation under such threat that they can't understand it. We can't understand it. The story can't even understand it. And what's even more disturbing than in all of that is that Eleanor's strangely not afraid, because she's so wound up in wanting everyone to like her and wanting people to be impressed with her. You know, she's so isolated and so in need of this recognition from these others, that she's just blind to what's happening to her and to how the house is attached to her and to what it's doing to her. Where by the end, she's, you know, as she's crashing her car into this tree and thinking, you know, I'm the one who's doing this. I'm really doing this all by myself. You know, almost, you know, insistently trying to convince herself. And then just in the last moments, well, why am I doing it? You know, this little moment of clarity, you know, if I'm really in control, why is it that I'm doing this? Of course, suggesting that she isn't in control. There is something here working on her mind. As we're told, you know, earlier in the story, is how the haunted houses tend to operate. You know, they work on your mind to get you to do things, whatever that means. It's a very disturbing story in a couple respects, but I think it's worth pointing out the formal respects, like how Jackson is accomplishing a lot of this, is by putting us in a situation that is not unlike Eleanor's situation, where we're not really sure whether these, what we're looking at. We're not really sure, like, what the situation is. We're not really sure, like, when Eleanor thinks about Eleanor and Theodora, you know, who are, we're told, you know, sensitives, people who have had past experience with the supernatural. Theodora, in one moment, is asked by Eleanor. Eleanor thinks something in one moment, and Theodora says almost the exact thing that Eleanor was thinking. She uses the same words. Is Theodora able to read Eleanor's mind? It establishes she has certain telepathic abilities. that she can, you know, to some degree read minds. That's established about Theodora, that, you know, the reason she's been invited to the house is that she's passed the card test supposed to be a determination of whether or not you have telepathic abilities on some level and are sensitive to picking up on, you know, what other people are thinking. And she does repeat verbatim something that Eleanor has said. So is Theodora, you know, somehow in league with this house, or does she herself have, you know, an ability to manipulate Eleanor? Or, you know, what is it that is going on here? We don't know. And Eleanor doesn't know. It's just a disturbing and unquieting set of moments that are happening here. And we're in that same position where we don't really know when that sort of moment like that happens. We don't know, and Eleanor doesn't know. If the narrator knows, they're not telling us. And the narrator will only really tell us what Eleanor is thinking in any complex way. And it certainly doesn't know what this house is thinking, whatever it thinks. It only knows that the house is not sane.
Let's look at a moment in Hill House, two moments in Hill House that are connected around the middle of the book. Now, this is the moments where the writing appears on the walls of the house. And there is, I think, a few things to notice here, but one of the most important things is to notice the reactions that characters have and that Eleanor has in both instances. So when the first we're told that the writing is large, you know, there's these large letters appear on the wall of the house in chalk, you know, they're written in chalk. Romy's large and striking ought to have looked, Eleanor thought, as if it had been scribbled by bad boys on a fence. Instead, it was incredibly real, going in broken lines over the thick paneling of the hallway. From one end of the hallway to the other, the letters went, almost too large to read, even when she stood back against the opposite wall. "Can you read it?" Luke asked softly, and the doctor, moving his flashlight, read slowly, "Help Eleanor come home." "No," and Eleanor felt the word stop in her throat. She had seen her name as the doctor read it. "It is me," she thought. "It is my name standing there so clearly. I should not be on the walls of this house." "Wipe it off, please," she said, and felt Theodora's arm go around her shoulders. "It's crazy," Eleanor said, bewildered. "Crazy is the world, right?" Theodora said strongly. "Come back inside, Nell, and sit down. Luca, get something to wipe it off." "But it's crazy," Eleanor said, hanging back to see her name on the wall. "Why?" Firmly, the doctor put her through the door into the little parlor and closed it. Luca's already attacked the message with his handkerchief. "Now you listen to me," the doctor said to Eleanor, "just because your name..." "That's it," Eleanor said, staring at him. "It knows my name, doesn't it? It knows my name." "Shut up, will you?" Theodora shook her violently. "It could have been any of us. It knows all our names." "Did you write it?" Eleanor said to Theodora. "Please tell me. I won't be angry or anything, just so I can know that. Maybe it was only a joke. To frighten me?" She looked appealingly at the doctor. "You know that none of us wrote it," the doctor said. Luke came in, wiping his hands on his handkerchief, and Eleanor turned hopefully. "Luke," she said, "you wrote it, didn't you, when you went out?" Luke stared, and then came to sit on the arm of her chair. "Listen," he said, "you want me to go writing your name everywhere? Carving your initials in trees? Writing Eleanor, Eleanor on little scraps of paper?" He gave her hair a soft little pull. "I've got more sense," he said. "Behave yourself." "Then why me?" Eleanor said, looking from one of them to the other. "I am outside," she thought madly. "I am the one chosen," she said quickly. And she said quickly, beggingly, "Did I do something to attract attention more than anyone else?" "No more than usual, dear," Theodora said. She was standing by the fireplace, leaning on the mantel and tapping her fingers. And when she spoke, she looked at Eleanor with a bright smile. "Maybe you wrote it yourself?" Angry, Eleanor almost shouted. "You think I want to see my name scribbled all over this foul house? You think I like the idea that I'm the center of attention? I'm not a spoiled baby after all. I don't like being singled out." "Asking for help, did you notice?" Theodora said lightly. "Perhaps the spirit of the poor little companion has found a means of communication at last. Maybe she was only waiting for some drab, timid. Maybe it was only addressed to me because no possible appeal for help could get through that iron selfishness of yours. Maybe I might have more sympathy and understanding. 1 minute then." "And maybe, of course, you wrote it to yourself," Theodora said again. And, you know, then they continued to fight in this way. I want to just quickly note the reactions here. So first off, we see this writing has appeared on the walls of the house, and it's in chalk, a rather unusual substance for it to be, you know, given the haunted house novel. Usually you find something more scary, like blood, for example, right? This is the trope of writing on the walls of a house. But it's in chalk. It could, they're very large letters. It's not impossible, but it is improbable that one of them could have written it. The doctor says so himself. But, you know, we don't know. It could have been one of these other people. We don't have this full access to everything
in the narration like we sometimes do in other novels. We have these gaps where we don't know what characters have been doing, and we're never told, except for Eleanor. We're always kind of with Eleanor, it seems. Again, we don't have like, you know, this full amount of information. Regardless, Eleanor reacts, of course, in a sensible manner. She's frightened. She's upset. She, you know, starts to freak out. And the characters, you know, initially at first kind of, you know, pull her away and try to calm her down, but she keeps, you know, ramping up. And at that point, I think it's very worthwhile noting that they turn on her. You know, they turn on her. Theodora, you know, is at first kind of, you know, putting on a show of being nice to Eleanor, hauls her away, puts her arm on her shoulders. But then all of a sudden she's distanced herself. She goes to the mantle. That's after Luke, of course, comes in. Eleanor asks Theodora, did you write it? Luke comes in. She asks, did you write it? You know, I won't be scared. You know, Eleanor's so used to being bullied and picked on that she just assumes that, you know, maybe it's not even the house. Maybe it's one of these people. That would make her feel better in a weird way, because of course she then wouldn't have been singled out by supernatural authority. But also, let's point out, this is the thing that Eleanor is used to. Eleanor is used to being a victim of the people around her. She's used to being bullied. And what happens? Well, they go right into bullying her. The second that she demands real attention, actually requires real care, they turn on her. They make fun of her, like, you know, you wish I would write your name on the walls of a house. You wish I would pay attention to a woman like you, but I'm not going to do that. Theodora, you know, similarly starts to berate her for being drab and, you know, timid and like a mouse-like, you know, what kind of person would pay attention to you, Eleanor, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they get very mean. They get very, you know, vicious. They're attacking her. Now, is it that the house has turned them on her? Does it influence their minds the way it seems later to be influencing Eleanor's minds? Is this just the social dynamics of, you know, what happens to people like Eleanor? Is it, you know, what is the explanation precisely? You know, it's hard to say, but the point is, she sees the letters, she's scared, seemingly rightfully so, to be singled out. And then she has a sensation that not only has the house singled her out, but these other people have now singled her out. You know, she's been separated from them. You know, she has that thought, we're told is a mad thought. This idea that, you know, she's being separated and singled out. She's horrified by this idea. And then, I think it's very important to note, she quickly moves her attention to these other people. You know, it's almost like within a page, she's no longer scared of the house anymore. What she's scared of now is the thing she's always scared of, which is these other people around her. And what are they going to do? How come they are going to treat her? You know, she's back to being a victim of other people. So that when the second time we have her name appear on the walls of the house, it appears differently, and two, the reaction is different. So in the first instance, the wording is, help Eleanor come home. Help Eleanor come home. Then the second time, we add a word. She has been frightened to see her name on the walls of the house. The second time it appears with her name twice on the walls of the house. Help Eleanor come home, Eleanor. I think it's interesting to just look at those words for a second. When you're just talking to help Eleanor come home, it's a phrase that could be addressed at the others. You know, help Eleanor come home. You know, if this Hill House is Eleanor's home in some mad way, then these people bullying her, victimizing her, in a sense, are trapping her outside of their social group, outside of maybe the protection that social group might offer. Their sort of vicious attack on her in this scene could very well be, in the weird way, they're helping her come home, you know, and of course, an unhelpful helping. You know, this is what's going to kind of make her the ultimate victim of the house, is her outcast status. that, you know, gets affected in this moment in reaction to the her name appearing on the walls. The second time is help Eleanor come home, Eleanor. If you put punctuation to this phrase, which of course it doesn't have, another way to read that is, you know, help Eleanor, come home, Eleanor. You know, as if it needs her there, it wants her there. You know, there's some draw to her. It's also, of course, I think, worth noting something that has happened in the backstory here is that Eleanor has been living with her mother, taking care of her in their home. Her mother has, you used to knock on the walls to summon Eleanor. And we have these moments where there's a strange knocking on the walls of Hill House, seemingly directed at Eleanor that terrifies her. We also have Eleanor having left, you know, her place, her home, and come here. And here's the kind of phrase that perhaps her mother might say if her mother was a ghost, if her mother was haunting Eleanor in some way, you know, demanding that she come back. It's not that this is what is happening necessarily, but you have all sorts of weird, interesting ways to interpret this line. You can put punctuation there and kind of see the different meanings it could have. You can think of Hill House as her home. You know, we have this sense before she comes to Hill House, she believes she's going to find a home there in a sense. She just believes she's going to find some new family, which, you know, she doesn't quite find. Instead, she, you know, falls in that same victim pattern. But that she did at home. So in a sense, she's found a new home, but it's a terrifying, horrible space. In another sense, you know, possibly there's this weird way in which she belongs here with the house, or at least the house is trying to convince her of that. And that's very much the idea that she has by the end. We also have just, you know, ways in which this could tie into a possible haunting in a more conventional sense, like Eleanor's mother haunting her. And she's brought a ghost into this house or what have you. We do very much have the idea planted early in this book that maybe Hill House is not haunted exactly, but Eleanor has brought ghosts here. Maybe people who are haunted come into the house and, you know, die and leave and start to haunt the house. You know, there's a lot of possibilities. But putting all the interpretations aside, look at the clear thing that we can see for sure is happening. There's another message. It appears in red. You know, they say it must be red paint. Possibly it's, of course, blood. This time I am ready, Eleanor told herself and said, you better get her out of here. Bring her to my room. This is, you know, shaky red letters on the wallpaper of Theodora's bed is where the message has appeared. This time, so Theodora is freaking out. And of course the paint is all over her clothes. This time I'm ready, Eleanor told herself and said, you better get her out of here. Bring her to my room. My clothes are ruined, Theodora said, the doctor. Do you see my clothes? Smell was atrocious, and the writing on the wall had dripped and splattered. There was a line of drops from the wall to the wardrobe. Perhaps it had first turned Theodora's attention that way, and a great irregular stain on the green rug. It's disgusting, Eleanor said. Please get Theo into my room. Eleanor is looking at the red paint. It must be paint, she told herself. It simply got to be paint. What else could it be? But why, you know? And her name, of course, is on there twice. And Theodora now is the one who is freaking out. Theodora now is the one who has to be babied. They're much kinder to Theodora than they were to Eleanor for whatever reason. But notice also that Eleanor is not afraid. She was, after that first interaction, what she comes out of it with is she's more afraid to be singled out and to be an outcast in this group. She's more afraid of the group's negative attention than she is of her name appearing in blood on the walls of a haunted house, so that when it happens, she's ready. She's been waiting for something like this. On one hand, there's the idea that possibly you have the interpretation here that could be very valid, that somehow Eleanor has manifested this second lettering. She's manifested this wish. She again possibly is haunted by a poltergeist. She again, you know, is possibly in the space where, you know, the house or this poltergeist or some combination is reacting strongly to what has happened previously. It's reiterated the scene, but in a more extreme manner, and has targeted Theodora, the woman who Eleanor targets in her mind, in a sense, you know, the woman who's been the most mean to her. and it tries to put Theodore into the Eleanor role. And Eleanor, you know, tries to put herself into Theodore's role. She tries to like take it up a different position in the social dynamics. She has been ready in a sense that she has been steeling herself for something else like this to happen. Not because she doesn't want, not for some reason that might make maybe sense to us if we were perhaps, you know, starting to see ourselves as a target of a haunting. Like, imagine if you were in the situation that Eleanor is in, and you start to, you know, you see your name written in chalk on the walls of this house after a number of unusual things have happened. You believe now, it seems very plain that you are the target of the haunting. Whatever is haunting this house is targeting you. At that point, rather than leaving the house, rather than, you know, being more afraid when you see this name appear again, your concern shifts to what are the other people going to think and do if something else happens? How will I get ready so that I'm not embarrassed? You know, she's more afraid of being embarrassed when something like this happens again. She's more afraid of, you know, what if I become the victim of negative attention again? How can I, you know, react and steel myself and ready myself to react differently so that when the house targets me a second time or another time, I'm going to be ready and I won't, you know, be such an embarrassment and won't become, you know, won't put myself in that position where I'm going to be bullied again. It's worth pointing out that as horrible as, you know, this haunting may be for Eleanor at this moment, the worst part of it is that other people are using it as an excuse to pick on her. It's a very sad and strange moment. And I think it indicates a few things. One, it kind of gets to the heart of what this book maybe is about on a thematic level, about how certain people in society, certain women in particular, you know, are treated with an unkindness and don't fit in to what maybe the society wants, the role that it wants them to have. You know, Eleanor is an unmarried, older for the time, unmarried older women, like for the time, this would be an old age to not be married. Of course, now it's pretty standard. But at the time, she would be a bit of an unusual woman in that she wouldn't be in a particularly conventional social role. Therefore, she's a problem woman in that sense. Possibly she has, you know, there's a suggestion throughout the novel that potentially she has, you know, some sort of queer desire. And therefore, again, is not maybe falling into a conventional role in the social fabric of the day. For these sorts of reasons, she's been put in a victim position where the society keeps, you know, harassing her fundamentally to conform. In different, you know, ways, people just have this unkindness towards her. And fundamentally, we have in this book, you know, a situation where it is better for Eleanor to die, to suicide herself in this house, than to leave it in shame and go back to her everyday life. Here we have seen an intense version of her everyday life. It's not that she prefers this version, but that she feels on a weird, deep level that she belongs here in this home for women who have, you know, been kind of bordering the fringes of society. This is the history of the house since its construction, that it is a place where women sort of on a fringe of society can, you know, live as horrible a life that, and maybe even death that it might be. And the house is, of course, working on her, you know, as the house might be working on her companions here, maybe turning them against Eleanor more fully and extremely than they might turn in a normal situation. It also seems to be working on Eleanor and kind of distracting her from maybe paying too much attention to what is going on around her and reacting in a normal sort of way. By the end of this book, again, it's worth noting when she's running around and almost dies running up the stairwell and so on. By that point in the book, when her behavior gets so extreme that they send her away from the house. And then, of course, when she suicides, driving her car into the tree, which I think I'll just also kind of look at that for a second. By that point, keep in mind, like, the house seems to have clearly influenced Eleanor, or she's just kind of, you know, always never been the most in control of herself, or fully, you know, aware of herself, and only now is kind of in a sad and strange way discovering who she is at the very end when it's too late. I think it's a very, it almost makes me tear up sometimes when I read this ending, because I just find it so, you know, interesting and, you know, sad. So as they're like driving away, or as they're waving away to Eleanor, they're sending her away. They're forcing her to leave the house. They're saying it's for her own good. But of course, there's a level at which they just don't want her there anymore. And she knows it. They just don't want her there anymore. She's the outcast. She senses that from the second she arrives, almost. Well, she has a bit of false hope when she arrives, but then from the time her name appears on the walls of the house, she senses, you know, I'm the one on the outside. It's confirmed by that point. And it just kind of gets worse and worse no matter what she tries to do. By the final end, they're sending her away. They're putting on a show of it's being a very happy send-off and it's all for her own good. You know, the house is affecting her too much. We can't have you here. It's too dangerous. They're right on a certain level. But Eleanor feels like, and I think it's fair to say that she's right in the sense about this, she feels like it's just a repeat of what always happens to her. She always gets put on the outside. They always, you know, send her away once she's no longer of any use to them. The second that she's not there, her mother dies, her sister doesn't want her around anymore. She only wanted her there so that she could take care of the mother and the sister when it have to. You know, that's very much the role Eleanor has had. You know, she's a person they use and use up and then throw away. And she has felt this way her whole life. She feels it again. And now she's being sent away. Goodbye, Eleanor said. So they all say their goodbyes. Goodbye, Eleanor said, and slid into the car. It felt unfamiliar and awkward. I'm too used already to the comforts of Hill House, she thought, and reminded herself to wave a hand from the car window. Note what's happening here. It's almost a sociopathic moment. She's talking to Hill about the comforts of Hill House. By this point, she's completely happy and comfortable in Hill House, this place that, you know, has been, it seems, trying to kill her. And, you know, all sorts of horrifying phenomenon have been happening. And yet, you know, she's just like, she's so happy there. But she's being sent away. But then the sociopathic aspect almost is she reminds herself to wave a hand from the car window. She has to, like, on a secondary level, remind herself to act like a normal person and to do the things a normal person might do in this moment. Goodbye, she called, wondering if there had ever been another word for her to say. Goodbye, goodbye. Clumsily, her hands fumbling, she released the brake and let the car move slowly. They waved back at her dutifully. Again, they're going through the show of it too. It's a kind of sociopathic ritual where nobody really has an emotion here that is the same emotion they're displaying. They're just going through motions of what is proper to display. They waved back at her dutifully, standing still, watching her. They will watch me down the drive as far as they can see, she thought. It is only civil for them to look at me until I'm out of sight. So now I am going. Journey's end and lovers meeting. But I won't go, she thought, and laughed aloud to herself. Hill House is not as easy as they are. Just by telling me to go away, they can't make me leave. Not if Hill House means me to stay. Go away, Eleanor, she chanted aloud. Go away, Eleanor. We don't want you anymore. Not in our Hill House. Go away, Eleanor. You can't stay here, but I can. She sang. But I can. They don't make the rules around here. They can't turn me out or shut me out or laugh at me or hide from me. I won't go. And Hill House belongs to me. Look at the turn here. She's come into this strange place. And it's perfectly understandable on a certain level. You know, a woman like this who's had this life and has gone through these experiences, if you take the haunting out of it, it almost makes perfect sense why she would feel this way. But add the haunting back in, something is working on her mind. With what she perceived as quick cleverness, this is the sort of brilliance of Jackson's prose, with what she perceived as quick cleverness. So she's doing a thing, and then there's a level at which she's perceiving what she's doing. And then there's this another level that the narrator is talking at, with saying, she perceives these things as being this way, but they're not precisely that way. If it was quick cleverness, it would, the narration would say, with quick cleverness, but it doesn't say that. It's negating the thing that she feels as it's telling us what she feels. With what she perceived as quick cleverness, she pressed her foot down hard on the accelerator. They can't run fast enough to catch me this time, she thought. But by now they must be beginning to realize. I wonder who notices first. We have this reference here. They can't run fast enough to catch me this time. This is referring to the previous moment where she had, again, maybe in her mind, she had attempted a suicide. And they caught her, they stopped her. Now she's attempting it again, but they can't stop her. And she realizes this. She can't, keep in mind, need to track this. She's realizing in a crystal clear way, I'm going to commit suicide this time. They won't stop me. They can't do it. I figured it out. I wonder who notices first. She's less concerned with the fact she's going to die as with who's going to notice that I'm going to die first? Luke, almost certainly. I can hear them calling now, she thought. And little footsteps running through Hill House and the soft sound of the hills pressing closer. Note that for a second. I can hear them calling now. They're calling to her. Maybe in reality, they are calling to her. Eleanor, what are you doing? Stop. But they can't get there fast enough. But then here's the other thing she hears. The little footsteps running through Hill House. Whose footsteps are these? The soft sound of the hills pressing closer. I'm really doing it, she thought, turning the wheel to send the car directly at the great tree at the curve of the driveway. I'm really doing it. I'm doing this all by myself. Now, at last, this is me. I'm really, really, really doing it by myself. It's a very strange and sad moment because this is look at how empowered she seems to feel. And yet, the only power she has here is to kill herself in full sight of them and, make them feel maybe what she feels for a moment. But then also note how that turns. In the unending crashing second before the car hurled into the tree, she thought clearly, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? Why don't they stop me? Look at how the moment turns. And you also have the suggestion that finally she's thinking clearly. She has one clear thought, which is to question what she's doing. Why am I doing this? It made perfect sense a second ago to her. And all of a sudden it doesn't make sense anymore, but it's too late. As if, the house has strangely and, horrifyingly allowed her a moment of clarity when it's just too late, just to experience the full terror of what she's really doing. Whatever is, maybe she's simply just having second thoughts, but it's too late. She has, why don't they stop me? Well, of course they can stop her. I mean, she's established that by this point. Even just previously, in this sort of interior monologue, she's established they can't stop her. There's nothing they can do. But I think there's an interesting deeper level where it really does suggest that this is clearly where things were going. Montague even talks earlier about a woman who did this exact same thing as she was leaving Hill House. There was a car accident in this exact manner. They call it an accident, but now we can see most likely it was a suicide. All the signs are here that this is going to end poorly for Eleanor. They even are sending her away because they think it's going to end poorly for her. So there is sort of this sense of on one hand, Eleanor seems responsible in this moment. She believes herself to be responsible in this moment. It's the only time she has ever felt fully responsible and fully in control. But at the same time, there's all these signs that not only is Hill House the one responsible, but in a strange way, her friends or the people she thought were her friends for a little while, they've been ignoring her. They've even in some ways been driving her to it, consciously or unconsciously. And at moments, they very much seem to be trying to drive her away. And here they get their wish.